All right, everybody. Well, let's get started. Welcome. My name is Missy Schnurstein, and I am your session MC for today. I'm so excited to be here to support the advancement of women leaders across the state and in this community. At Oath, we made the commitment a year ago that our leadership would be 50% women by the year 2020, and Watermark aligns with our vision to create a truly diverse and inclusive workplace. So we're so proud to be a partner of the California Conference for Women. The Conference for Women is so wonderful as it offers a blend of proactive tools, advice, inspiration, I'm sure you guys have already been inspired a little bit this morning, and peer networking. So have some fun networking today. So we're doing a mix of sessions committed to empowering you, your empowerment, inspire you so that you guys can make your mark in your workplace, in your communities, your companies, your careers, and spread that to those around you. So thank you for coming and participating in this session for Creative Change. We have an amazing hour and session for you. I'm very excited to introduce to you Jennifer Mueller. Jennifer earned her PhD at Brandeis. She's been on the faculty of many of our top business schools here in the U.S., Wharton, the Yale School of Management, NYU Stern, not too shabby. One of her papers went viral. It was called The Bias Against Creativity. And She has a book that you should check out. I just read it. It's fantastic. It's called Creative Change and Why We Resist It. It gives you a really cool roadmap to kind of how to think about changing the way you think and influencing that with others as well. It's very cool. She's a native Californian, a native Southern Californian like myself. I'm very excited to introduce. Please put your hands together for Jennifer Mueller.
Thank you. Hi, everyone.
Hi, everyone. like Missy said, I am a native Californian. In fact, I was the original Valley Girl. Oh, no. Like, oh, my God. Totally. Gag. I won't do anymore because I understand I want people to come in and not stay out. But yes, I'm a Californian, so it's lovely to be amongst in my home state. Giving this talk and talking about this, but to also an audience in California, you know, we take innovation really seriously. We love innovation. It's something that's a passion for us. So you can imagine why I gravitated towards it, because when I started my career, I was at Brandeis in Boston. And I remember thinking to myself, hey, you know, it might be cool to study marriage. Marriage is so interesting, right? Like, why am I studying marriage? I don't know. That's how I started my career. Except it killed my dating life. I mean, I would go out on dates, right? And usually in my experience, the guy says, so what do you do? And me, I was so excited and bushy-tailed and bright-eyed, and I said, I study marriage. And the date would sort of wind down, and he wouldn't call. And I thought, I have to change my tactics, you know. So I had this wonderful opportunity to work with a professor over at Harvard Business School named Teresa Amabile. For those of you who are creativity diehards like me, you'll know that Teresa is one of the mothers of creativity theory. If you've had any kind of training in creativity, her work has probably influenced that. And she had, at the time, a database of about 230 people who wrote about their daily diary experiences, their daily events, over the course of anywhere from 2 to 3 months to a year. So I had the opportunity to read 12,000 events from these 230 people, all working on creative products and projects in companies, in large corporations, that encouraged creativity. And so one of the things that became really interesting about this, as I read this, is I'm hearing the dialogue that's going on in the field at the time and the things that creativity people were talking about. And that dialogue was, creative ideas are so rare and so precious. So we want to generate more of them. So let's figure out how to generate. So I'm reading these daily diaries, and I noticed something that shocked me. 60% of people in these companies during the time period that we studied them mentioned that they had, in their view, a breakthrough idea during the day, during the course of their work. So 60%. So it wasn't really rare. It wasn't the sense of only 10% of people had this experience. Many people in this sample were having this experience. The second thing that I noticed that was very odd to me At the time, the conversation was all about how, you know, if you feel good, you'll be more creative. You heard that work? You know, you feel good, you're doing something pleasant or positive, you have a gift or hear music, and you're more likely to be creative for all kinds of reasons. And what I found was that being creative made people feel good. Not just good, elated. Okay? Like the best thing that has ever happened in your life, elated. And they would talk about creativity as if their life now makes sense and has meaning because they had this idea. So it was a feeling of joy. And the third thing that I saw was that joy ended pretty quick when they shared their idea with somebody else. And that was, wait a minute, I thought to myself, hold on, what? People are feeling joy and then sharing these ideas, but other people they're sharing them with are not feeling this joy. They are having a very different experience. And it got me thinking that there might be a different skill. So there's this, how do you generate the idea? How do you take the idea, a kernel of an idea, and bring it forward? And in that way of thinking and thinking about creativity is about something that redefines something else. So you have a beginning product of status quo, and you take that status quo, you repurpose it, you redefine it, you tweak it, you change the way in which a solution in another domain is being used. So that's how I think about creativity. I think about creativity as thinking different in the sense of you are changing your perspective, changing the definition, changing the way you're using something from how it's commonly used to use it in a totally new way. It hasn't been used that way before. And the focus at the time was, you know, generate more. The more ideas, the better, right? And you see this conversation amongst executives that say, you know, we had 3,000 ideas to choose from, and we chose the 5 best. And the idea there is that if you have a large pool of ideas, you have the higher likelihood of choosing one that's great, right? I mean, that would make sense. And then something else I realize is going on. What about those people choosing those ideas? What's that about? How do they know how to do that? How do they know which idea is, in fact, the best? Let me ask you, how many of you have had some kind of training on how to generate creative ideas? Just a show of hands. Okay, so many of you have had this kind of training. How many of you have had training on how to recognize potential in ideas? Okay. Some of you have raised your hands, but many fewer of you. What this spoke to me was there was this other thing going on that people are recognizing or needing to recognize these ideas as decision makers, but we weren't spending the kind of time and energy helping them figure out how to do this. And they're the leaders, right? That's fundamentally one of the major things leaders do. Managers, leaders, people in high-level positions, gatekeepers, they're the ones that determine which ideas live and die. And they're not really given any training about how to do this. And that was curious to me because there was so much training on the other side, the generation side, but not as much training on this other side. So it spoke to this idea of maybe people just don't think you need training. Maybe people think this is an obvious thing. You want a creative idea that's new, and so you just choose one. What's the problem? And I want to ask you a question, or rather, give you an opportunity to raise your hands. How many of you in this room hate creativity? Please raise your hands. Nobody's raised their hands. Usually there's one or two. Okay. Please raise your hands, however, if your creative idea was rejected by somebody else. So look around the room. Wait, hold your hands up high so you can see. Do you see the disconnect here? And someone's still raising their hands. It was a really bad rejection. I totally feel you. So there is this puzzle. And what I want to pose is that one possibility is that we don't think we hate creative ideas. But what if we do? What if we really hate creative ideas? Maybe we're not aware of it. Maybe it's in certain circumstances and not others. And what if we have this love-hate relationship? And what if that's part of what's explaining part of the problem that you're seeing, that your ideas are being rejected? So let me unpack this a little bit more and talk to you about my experience. So I'm one of these people that kind of wanders around and asks questions, and people say, that's stupid. And I think, is it stupid? Wait a minute, why is it stupid? I'm very stubborn and perhaps not focusing on social cues. So one of the questions I first started to ask when I was a grad student, I went into an engineering firm and I talked to a line manager and I said to him, okay, so I want to know, what role does creativity play in your everyday work? And in this context, they were making pharmaceuticals. And this manager turned to me and said, creativity? I'm not an artist. I mean, if I do something wacky, patients could die. To which I said, oh, okay. So let me rephrase. Creativity doesn't play a role in your everyday work. Necessarily, to which he replied, you know what? I take offense to that. If I'm not innovative every day, people could die of cancer. So I was confused. I didn't understand. So then I started asking decision makers in Fortune 500 companies. So oftentimes, and many of you may have been one of these decision makers or seen this happen, when companies want to cull the creative ideas, right? So they ask for white papers, or they ask for products or prototypes, and then a group of people sit down and look at all of these and determine which ones they want to implement. And in this particular company that said it valued innovation was its key strategy. I figured this would be a good place to ask the question about what role creativity played in how they made decisions, right? So I didn't know that was a stupid question to ask. Apparently it was. When I said, so, you know, what role does creativity play in how you make decisions about which of these ideas you choose? They said, well, we need a large market, and we need it to be congruent with our strategy, and we need it to be feasible. We need to know that this is a real market, not something that just is a fly-by-night sort of thing. And he went on and on. And so I rephrased the question. I said, so what are you saying? Are you saying creativity isn't part of how you make this decision? And then he kind of looked at me and gave me that look. You know that look. And he said, creativity? You know what? I don't care if ideas are creative. I care if ideas make a profit. So I thought, okay, all right, that really makes sense, right? What does it matter if ideas are creative? And then I was giving my spiel to this executive at Apple University. And I was saying to him, you know, creativity is important and whatnot. And he said to me, you know what, Jen? Can I channel Steve Jobs for a minute? Does anybody here? I just did not want him to channel Steve Jobs at that moment. Right? I was thinking to myself, oh, no, this is not good. This is his beginning of a criticism of what I have just said. But I girded my loins and I said, okay. And he said, you know what? I don't care if ideas are creative. I care if ideas are great. And I sat back and I thought, oh gosh, he's right. I'm stupid. What am I doing spending all this time thinking about whether or not ideas are creative? Who cares? All the people want are solutions that solve problems for a large market that can make a profit. They don't care if ideas are new or not. And that's when I conducted a study. And during this time, and at this time, this was a company that really valued creativity, said creativity was its number one resource. It was so important to the company. Creativity was part of the name of the company. It was in every document they send out. And what they did was they had a bunch of white papers they culled from all of the people that worked there about new product offerings. And they had a committee that sat down and evaluated all those white papers to determine which ones they wanted to implement. So what my team and I did was we asked those decision makers, okay, tell us how creative those ideas are, each of these white papers is. Tell us how feasible each is to implement in the company. Tell us how familiar you are with these ideas and how profitable they are. And we asked many people in the organization. So we had a large pool of people rate all these ideas. We also had customers rate these ideas, their customers, their clients, the people that they wanted to sell more to, in terms of how desirable each of these ideas were. How much would you be willing to buy this if they put this forward? And what surprised us, or what didn't surprise us, after you've heard, you know, Steve Jobs, was that the decision makers themselves, indeed, implemented ideas they thought were more familiar to them and more feasible, right? And the ideas they thought were going to be more profitable, right? And will not surprise you to know at all that the extent to which ideas were seen as creative by people in the company was negatively related to whether or not they were seen as feasible. They even profitable. They didn't see them as feasible. They didn't see them as profitable. They didn't implement them. But they did implement the things they thought were feasible and familiar and profitable. Fine, right? We've heard this story before. But what might surprise you is that the ideas that customers said they wanted were not the profitable ideas, the ideas seen as profitable by those in the organization, or the feasible ideas. They were the creative ones. As a matter of fact, the extent to which those decision makers thought those ideas were super feasible, low-hanging fruit, was negatively, strongly negatively correlated to whether or not customers wanted to buy these ideas, buy these solutions. So I thought, wait a minute, Steve, because I had this conversation with Steve. He's, I don't think, having it with me, but that's okay. I'm like, Steve Jobs, listen, you know, ideas being great, there's something going on here. There's something happening. And there's also, if you've studied this for a while and you kind of search in the literature, you see this puzzle emerging. The strange paradox of people really want creative ideas, but they reject them all the time. And you see this in many different ways of thinking about this and examples I'm sure many of you have experienced. One of the most common examples is during a brainstorming meeting. Now, how many of you have been in brainstorming meetings? Okay, everyone in this room. And you're all laughing because you know where I'm going, right? Think about brainstorming meetings, though, is when they start, you'll notice people having a great time. It's fun. You're enjoying yourself. But this is how people feel at the end. Why is that? How could this be? Well, when I asked people, they said, you know, after 2 hours of brainstorming, they decided to make a small wording change. You know, I wasted my time. There are great ideas here. Why didn't we implement them? So this is an example of the great ideas are there. They're in front of us. You can just reach out and grab them, except they're not. And this is not the only domain where we see this. We see lots of examples. I'm sure every time somebody is really successful, they talk about all their rejections, right? It's successful and creative. Here's one. George Orwell wrote this book called Animal Farm. I think it was I can't remember the year, but decades ago. And one of the things he was told by a publisher, of course, this is an American classic, I think it was recently on the New York Times bestseller list, is that it's impossible to sell animal stories in the United States. Just impossible. Some of you may know Star Wars, maybe. So Star Wars in the 1970s was initially rejected by a host of film studios, including Disney, who owns the rights today and is making a ton of money. So there is evidence that the extent to which people feel comfortable seeing creative ideas as great is tough. Instead, people think great ideas are the feasible ones that are familiar. I'm sorry, great ideas are the feasible ones that are familiar, the good ideas. And so what's happening is people are rejecting the creative ideas that are great and instead embracing the non-creative ideas, that are good. And I wanted to know why this was. Because how could this be? Why do you say you want creativity and you don't really want it? Could it just be that people are just giving lip service to the idea of creativity? Could it be it's trendy? So I wanted to examine that. So I went into the laboratory. And what we do in social science, because I'm a social scientist, is when we want to know the exact reason for something, we go into the laboratory because it's a very controlled context. Like in an organization, a million things are going on, and there are many different things that could be operating to explain what's happening. So we went into the laboratory here, and we had students at a liberal arts university complete one of two tasks. So we randomly assigned them to write an essay in response to the statement, for every problem, there are multiple solutions, and for every problem, there is one correct solution. So they wrote an essay in response to this, and then we gave them two kinds of tests. The first kind of test was we said to them, okay, this word creativity, how important creativity is it to you? How important is this to you? tell us, versus practicality. Just tell us how much you like creativity. We also gave them a reaction time test. Have any of you taken the IAT, the reaction time test, implicit attitude test? Okay, so I'll go into some detail here. So the implicit attitude test is a way to capture your automatic associations with things. And what we find is that this test is hard to fake, right? It's hard to have a socially desirable response because you're basically just pressing buttons and showing what you associate with what. The second thing about this test is it tells you the strength of the association by the speed with which you pair words. That's the idea. And we also find that sometimes what you say you like, your explicit views, can be different than your reaction times. Right? And for all kinds of reasons. And so what we did was we gave them this test and we used the word creativity and we said, okay, to what extent do you pair words like creativity with words like rainbow, sunshine, and cake versus agony, hell, and ugly? Okay, how fast are you at pairing these kinds of words? And so what we found, which will not surprise you, is that for those in the condition where they wrote in response to the question, for every problem there are multiple solutions, they said they love creativity. When we asked them, how much do you love creativity? And the reaction time test showed us that they paired words like creative with heaven faster than words like vomit. And by the way, partially true also for the condition where for every problem there is one correct solution. They told us they love creativity. They said, oh, creativity is great, wonderful, but their reaction time tests associated creativity with words like vomit more so than sunshine, peace, and heaven. So for people who are in this mindset of I'm looking for a correct solution, I need something that's accurate, I need not to make an error, I also need to follow a paradigm. We understand correct solutions. They're important in our lives because if it's correct, it means if it fails, at least if other people around us think it's correct, if it ultimately fails, you know, we're protected a little bit in our decision making, if we have to justify decisions. But correct means vomit. So what this means is also that this bias, it's hidden. It's hidden. You don't see it. You're not going to see it. The leaders in your organization are not going to say, I hate creativity. How many of you have had a leader that said, I hate creativity, I hate innovation? It's not what we do here. Anybody? Of course. They don't say this. It's hidden. It's underground. Basically, it's like gender bias. It's more similar to gender bias because there are these norms, especially in California, in American culture, not to say you hate innovation. That is not true everywhere, but it is true in the United States. So in the United States, this bias is here. It is rampant. It is hidden. And it is happening with liberal arts students. It is also automatic. It means that people can have a knee-jerk negative reaction to hate ideas. And you see this in meetings where someone says, oh, yeah, this is horrible, and then they move on. They didn't spend the time to consider the idea, engage with the idea, have a dialogue about the idea, think through how they could improve the idea, right? So the bias, the warning sign is quick decisions. And what we have found since is that when it comes to new ideas, people are more likely to, when they choose familiar ideas and they reject new ideas, they're more likely to make quick decisions without deliberating when they reject novel ideas in favor of ideas that are not novel. And so, in other words, it's not that people are making these decisions to choose novel ideas and they're making errors. It's that the process determines if they're making errors. Quick decisions versus you're actually engaging in a dialogue with the idea. So this bias can be automatic. It's also situational. It doesn't always happen. There are certain situations that turn it off and turn it on. And in what we found and have since found is that one of the major moments this bias happens is when people are in leadership roles. When someone's in a leadership role, they want correct solutions. They are accountable for what they do. They want to justify their decisions to others and may be called upon to do so. They feel responsible for making good decisions. And so being in a leader, you have more of these pressures to want correct solutions than you do when you're not in a leadership role. It's also, which is caused by this desire to be correct, it's also not dispositional. We did not find necessarily that there were certain people that were immune to this bias. Instead, we found that most people, when we put them in a certain situation, they showed evidence of this bias, even if they were super open to experience and super creative and whatnot. So this bias is not something that's just about certain people versus others, necessarily. And so I will say to you, anyone can be biased against creativity, including my friends you, and including me. Let me tell you about my bias against creativity. And this is rather embarrassing. I was once teaching a class on creativity. And I asked students to generate as many unusual uses for a cardboard box. And this is a typical task that people who study creativity run all the time. I had run it many times. I had seen the gamut of uses, everything from a spaceship to, you know, runway clothes for fashion. And so I was particularly surprised when one group of students raised their hands and said, "Professor Mueller, we came up with an idea. We want to share it with you." I said, "Great. What's the idea?" They said, "A solar oven." And what happened was very interesting, and this has never happened to me before in public like this, but what happened immediately was I felt this, what's that? And my ick feeling came out, and my mouth opened and said, "What is that?" To which the students responded, "Well, it's, you know, something you can put food in, and you put it in the sun," and they explained it to me. And I said, "Does anything like that actually exist?" I said this in a classroom while teaching creativity. Okay? And then one student noted, "Oh, yes, actually, here it is online for, you know, almost $300. Yeah, it exists. It's useful. People need it." Oh, gosh. And what struck me about this, though, was that I had just published the paper on the bias against creativity. And I'm supposed to know how to overcome this bias, right? I published the paper. No, I didn't. And that's the second thing that I realized was interesting was I wasn't actually rejecting their idea. I didn't know what their idea was. I didn't really understand it anyways. I wasn't rejecting their idea. I was rejecting the uncertainty, the loss of expertise that the idea made me feel in the moment. I did not want to approach that idea because if you're a professor, you're supposed to know the answers, right? And not only that, you know, you have a lot of pressure to grade people fairly. If you give one person a C and one person an A, you better have a darn good reason why you give that person a C, because that grade can impact where they, you know, other opportunities that they might have. And so when you're in that role, and I think of being a professor as one kind of leadership role, you feel a huge pressure to be correct and desire to make decisions that are good because you have a lot of accountability, but you also feel responsible to your students. And that knee-jerk reaction happens so automatically, and my response was so automatic that it frankly surprised me and disappointed me in myself. But I found out I was not alone. There was a study done by IBM, and they surveyed 1,500 C-suite executives, and they said, what is the key leadership competency in today's global complex world? They said the key leadership competency was creativity, but not creativity in the context of generating lots of ideas and coming up with prototypes. No, no, no. They were thinking of creativity as disrupting the status quo, making decisions to see opportunities and moving in new directions. They were thinking of creativity like I was started to wonder about creativity early on when I was doing this work, that there are these decisions that are being made by people in gatekeeper roles, and they literally have to disrupt an organization. But I realized, disrupt how they think. If you can't disrupt how you're thinking, how can you recognize something that has value that is disruptive to the paradigm, right? And what's interesting about this study is even though they nominated this disrupting, how people think, disrupting the status quo as the number one leadership skill, over 50% said they didn't know how to do this. They had no practices and no skills. They weren't trained. This is something they were expected to do. But they didn't necessarily know, which I thought was staggering. And then I thought more like, what is it behind this thing that people feel so much anxiety about? That people feel when they encounter a creative idea, what's really lurking underneath all of that? And what I recognized was that creative ideas are fundamentally uncertain. You just don't know if a creative idea is going to work. And this creates what I call an ick response, automatic ick response, not able to control, something that if you're unprepared for the ick, it can dominate the conversation and you will reject any idea. So being prepared seems to be really important for this ick. It's going to happen, especially if the idea isn't yours. If the idea is yours, you're going to love it. That's the way it goes. The idea is yours, you are not going to love it. The ick comes from the desire to be correct. People in leadership roles with responsibility feel more of this need to be correct because they're online. And this notion of I don't know is not seemingly socially acceptable when people evaluate ideas. This idea of, like, we don't know what this idea will ultimately turn into. That's not part of the conversation I usually hear. And also there's this question of ick could mean if this new thing is implemented, you could lose your expertise, right? You're no longer expert anymore if this new thing comes and dominates. Let me show you an example. There was a study conducted by Paige Moreau and her colleagues, and what they did was looked in 1999 at the digital camera versus film. And they asked a group of people to say, okay, evaluate the digital camera versus and evaluate film. Just evaluate both. Tell us how you like both. And what they found was that experts, those who had experience in film, they loved film, and they hated the digital camera. Novices loved the digital camera, thought it was great, thought it had tons of potential. And when they went deeper to figure out what it was that experts were struggling with, they said, digital camera, it's a low-quality picture, right? You don't need dark rooms or film speed for a digital camera. And these are things that are critical for film quality. And look at the picture. It's pixelated. Who's going to want this? And what's amazing about that is they were right. Right? They were right. They were correct. It was a low-quality picture relative to film. It was. We all knew that. So why did we buy the digital camera? Because we didn't care as much about the quality of the picture. We cared about the immediacy. You could take a picture at your friend's wedding and know if that picture looked decent at the moment and not have to wait for 3 or 4 weeks later when the picture came out in the film development and you saw that it wasn't so great and then you missed this moment. So this immediacy was the game the novices were playing and the experts were playing a different game. They wanted to be correct and they were, but they were also dead wrong. So if you want to think about why did I have the bias against the solar oven, you said, Jen, if you knew about solar ovens, you wouldn't have had a bias against it. If you had expertise, it diminishes the bias. And I'll tell you, unfortunately, expertise makes the bias worse. Much worse. Having experts on your panel is not a cure. It's not only no cure, it makes it so that you are more likely to reject the new. Because experts are using the paradigm they're expert in. And novel ideas can break paradigms. Right? They do things differently. So one of the things I wanted to talk about is what do you do with this now? There is a bias against creativity. It can be evoked, especially when you're in this role where you need to be correct. How do we fix the problem? There are two pathways. One is teaching yourself and training yourself to engage in the practices to recognize creativity. The second is, how do you champion creativity and sell creative ideas? I'm going to focus today on the recognizing part. There's a second story, but we don't have time for the whole story. The recognizing part. So here are the four practices. This comes from the best research that we have now. And I hope this will change, and there'll be better research. I'm sorry to tell you the bad news. There's going to be ick. And part of what it means to recognize a creative idea and to know you've done it is that you've embraced this ick. So what this means is something counterintuitive. Good decision making in many contexts is I feel confident about my decision. I looked at all the variables, I feel confident. People that choose creative ideas do not feel confident. They don't know if the idea will change. Is this going to be the same idea now as it will be in future? What kinds of are the consequences of implementing this idea? They don't feel confident. So if you see people be really confident in their decision making, the likelihood is they haven't embraced the ick and they're showing a bias against novelty. Ironically, Jeff Bezos has a great strategy. He'll sit around a meeting, and he knows that people have the bias, right? He knows it. He lives this. And in the meeting, he'll say, okay, let's evaluate this idea, and everybody says they hate it, right? Oh, it's not feasible. We don't know if there's a market. We have no idea if this will work. And he says, okay, let's do it. Let's do it. And critical is that he says, we can't know. We can't know if this product will be as we say, because it breaks some of the rules. It's something that's never been done before, so we really can't know. I mean, you can say it's not feasible, but you really don't know. You don't know until you're in it. Sometimes ideas that you've done many, many times before cannot be feasible because the environment changes. Right? And all of a sudden, the thing you were doing before isn't feasible. So it doesn't mean that the familiar thing is going to be even more feasible than the new thing. He knows this. And he understands it. And he lets everybody off the hook by having everybody agree, say no, no, because they're accountable. And then he says, let's do it anyways. And he takes on the responsibility. This other feature of I focused about this need to be correct. And this is pervasive in our culture. How many of you use the word best all the time? Best practice? I use it all the time. I use it all the time with my students. It's a wonderful tool. It's an influence strategy. To say something is a best practice, you're saying, look, you know, the best people use it, you should too, and it works. It works. But it also kills creativity. Because creative ideas are, by definition, not the best yet. Right? Creative ideas don't have metrics. Creative ideas, you can't know if a creative idea is better than something else. You haven't proven it yet. You can only know if something is the best, if you already have information about whether or not that idea is great. This is what happens in brainstorming meetings all the time. I see this all the time. They say, let's choose the best idea. And that's where they go. When you say that to your people, you are saying, do not choose creative ideas. Don't choose anything new. Because we can't know if they're best. So I would urge you, make a small shift. This small shift can really change the game in your teams. The small shift is instead of, try, and this is tough, because the word best is so much part of how we talk today. Change the word best to potential. You're looking for ideas with potential. Potential means you don't know yet whether or not the idea will be the best. It might be. You don't know. So it allows for the reality that ideas change a lot. We don't know. They might be playing a different game and appeal to customers in a way that we never thought we needed to before. But they may not even realize needed to before. And so another way to think about shifting your mindset is to think about experimenting. So a lot of people, when they're brainstorming, they think, okay, which idea is the low-hanging fruit we can use right now that's quick that we need to do? And that's fine. Unlikely to lead to a creative idea, because creative ideas take a long time to develop. Another way to handle it is to experiment. And in fact, small-scale experimentation is a way to go. Here is a headline, this notion of the 10,000-hour rule, meaning you do something and you work on something for 10,000 hours. And there's this view of throw that out the window. Don't try to make it perfect. Experiment, the 10,000 experiment rule. And what we find is, and what I find more recently, there's a paper that's about to come out. We've looked at these teams, at project teams, and how they keep novel ideas alive. And one of the key things they do is they think of the idea not as the final idea, but as something that will change. It might be the idea ultimately they choose, but it's going to change, so we're just going to keep it alive. And that's how they keep it alive. They keep experimenting. They keep adding. They keep shifting it. They treat the idea like it's a placeholder. like it's something that can just move forward over time. And that seems to really help this mindset shift of we're going to experiment. This is not the final thing. It's going to change in perhaps in ways that help us overall. So there's this notion of verbal prototyping. So sometimes you don't have the resources to prototype all your white papers. So what I see teams doing is verbal prototyping, coming up with specific examples, talking through how it might work, talking through analogous situations where it did work, what it looked like, what it felt like. So that's another way to experiment, even though you don't actually spend money going out into the field trying to get the data. So embrace the Ikaros switch. The second, what we've found, which is really interesting, is that people have different definitions of creativity. Did you notice that? There are leaders and the way they view creativity, and then there's everybody else. And I've seen this where people say the word creativity and you're in a leadership role, and what you mean in your head is something that's feasible, something that's quick to market, something that is socially approved of, meaning you're going to have a lot of consumers, a mass market. Is open to you with this idea. That's what they mean. It turns out that people in the world, employees and consumers, when they see the word mass market, they think that means it's not creative. So one of the examples would be Apple that had the mass market wearable. Do you remember? So this is Apple, right? The institution that has the reputation about being creative and thinking different, they market their watch as a mass market device. They market their watch with a cue that's not creative. So in other words, if you're not careful, if you have a reputation as creative or you want to sell something as creative, you can communicate the wrong cues to your consumer and kind of decrease that excitement, because creativity we love. Remember, I started the talk by saying, you know, we really love creativity. It's true. Across all cultures, people say positive things about creativity. But what they mean is positive is different, is my point. So different communities have different beliefs, and part of it's driven by do they want to be correct? When you want to be correct, it shifts what you talk about when you say creativity. And it's important to kind of realize that when you're both leading people and also trying to communicate to your consumers. So adopting the consumer cue to creativity, or rather adopting and understanding that other people may have different views than you do about what creativity is. And if you want to appeal to them, you have to communicate ideas in ways that resonate with them, as opposed to turn them off when it comes to creativity. And now we're going to talk about metrics. So metrics are really important because creative ideas, the metrics that you have about them are never as good as the status quo. By definition, they haven't been tested yet to the extent to which the status quo has been tested. And so what I say is in the field, metrics can't tell you the future when it comes to an idea. Metrics are important. They tell you perhaps problems you want to solve, but they don't, when it comes to new ideas, tell you the value. They can be misleading about the value. And so what we see is that Silicon Valley investors, angel investors, interestingly, they don't focus on the metrics. And part of the reason why is they know the metrics at the time of any idea, there are many studies that have come out and shown this. The metrics at the time you're evaluating an idea do not correlate with success. They do not correlate with profitability. There is no relationship with how profitable people think things will be and then how profitable they ultimately are later. We're not seeing that people are good at predicting that and forecasting that. They're just not good at it. But what they are good at is telling whether or not the inventor has the wherewithal, has the savvy, has the drive to keep the idea moving forward and developing and becoming better. And so the investors that focus on the inventor's characteristics of being somebody who can experiment and who can engage in some of these practices, they make money. They're able to find the unicorns more likely than those who just look at the metrics. So metrics, we're not impressed with metrics, generally. The most important thing I can leave you with, though, here today, is to be yourself. What I have found in my work is that every person in this room can be creative. Even if you think you are not creative, this is something you want to do more of, I have seen it is the evidence is definitive that every person has the ability to be phenomenally creative. Every person. Doesn't matter how much of, I don't know, the skill set that you have or when you can learn this, and you may already have it. And furthermore, you need to. It is wired in every single person in this room to be curious, to want to be distinctive. It's part of a need, a fundamental need. We want to belong. We also have a need for novelty, to find things that are new. They found most recently a wonderful study that showed that marriages that survive, they seek novelty in those marriages. Say, back to marriage. See, knew I was going to relate it. And furthermore, creativity makes you feel elated. We're finding more and more that creativity makes you feel like your life has purpose, has meaning, that you've contributed something distinctive that is you to the broader picture. It's why people will work for nothing to be creative, to have cool jobs. And this skill of recognizing creativity, just like generating creativity, is key for invention. So this is the second piece of the puzzle that I urge you to go out and learn more about as all of you in this room create. So be yourself is the last bit. Thank you very much.
Hey, that was fantastic. That was so insightful, and I feel so inspired to go back to work next week and employ some of that because I felt you were talking directly to me. It's like, oh my gosh, yes, that's me. So you guys, we have time for a couple questions. We have some mics here, so go ahead and start lining up if you have questions. And while you guys are getting started to line up for some questions, I have a question for you while we're waiting for everyone. So yeah, I feel very inspired to go back to work next week, and I feel like I know what to bring and how to be more open-minded and how to reposition. But do you have any strategies on what I and everyone else can do to influence others to take on this type of behavior?
Yeah, and my experience is the studies that have come out that look at pitching strategies. You can use analogies, and we talk about it in the book, other kinds of strategies. It's very hard to get a pitch right. Because if that person is that decision maker in that position, it's hard to change their mindset. It's hard to change their mind. They're set. And so pitches, selling does matter, but it's not clear how much it matters in the moment of the pitch. That in fact, if you want to sell ideas, one thing that I've seen does work is getting them at a much earlier part of the decision-making process before they've seen the idea, like at the water cooler, floating the idea by them, and I call this a feedback pitch. You're not really trying to get feedback. The feedback pitch is, go up to your boss, and you're like, hey, I had this idea. What do you think? And what you really want to know is what he's going to reject, right? And because he's going to reject something, or she's going to reject something. And then you can say, oh, that's interesting. And then comes the negotiation. What if we did this? What do you think about this? And that negotiation's tough because you don't want the idea to become vanilla, right? You want it to have the soul that it was supposed to have. So presumably in the moment you can say, you know, let me work on that. And then put it in email form, thank you so much, and presuming you mean it, say, you know, I made these changes, I think it made it better. And sometimes in my experience, I find that a wording change can make the difference. This is true also of legal, okay? Legal has been called, unfortunately, the Department of No by most people who do any kind of product development, right? And so one of the things that they say is you come to me at the final hour, and this isn't even ethical or legal. Why are you, you know, and so, but if you catch them much earlier, they don't have that ick response, or if they do, it can subside a little bit later when they see the idea later. So part of the feedback pitch is managing that ick, because you expect to have it, but managing it up front so that their emotions can kind of calm down a little bit. And then they can feel comfortable like, oh, yeah, I get that. Just make this wording change and it'll be fine. So that's one, I hope, helpful.
It is helpful. It's great. It's good. I like it. Keep the questioning going. Keep working on it. That's great. So should we start? Do we want to start?
Sure. Thank you very much. I'm curious about, as we build our ick tolerance.
Yes. Ick resistance.
Ick resistance. How do we contrast that with building resiliency? Because when we get resilient, we're accepting what's there, we're doing that. And then when we get ick, we're kind of in the outside the comfort zone area. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
I think of them as the similar tasks. Do you know what I mean? Like, I feel like, because we're all going to feel the ick is fine, the ick is normal. It's not that there's something wrong with you or you're not innovative if you feel it, but the building resiliency is learning to stay in the moment with the ick and continue to think and to continue to wonder, because it could be that something wonderful comes from it. So that's how I see, the connection between the two.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, with respect to being a champion for creativity, I believe there was a study done by Google a while back on what is the commonality across groups that were highly successful in innovation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they came out with the idea that the group created a trusted environment so that everybody could feel free to express their ideas and innovate and not be criticized or shut down. Mm-hmm. And maybe is that possibly an additional sort of aspect of being a champion for creativity?
Yeah, we in our work are not finding that because there's something else that needs to happen, and it's correlated with trust, and that is respect. In other words, you can trust a lot of people, but remember, you have that ick response. So if you trust them, that can also create the negative event, right? Where I trust you, you're having ick. Oh, maybe I don't like that idea so much. Maybe it really does stink. So there's that piece to the group dynamic. What we find instead that keeps it alive in groups, like keeps ideas from dying early, is when somebody says, oh, it's horrible, you know, they have to start that conversation, right? It's awful, it's all these reasons. If somebody comes out and says, wait a minute, actually, it's great. If you look at it this way, it's great. It's been done here. It was really successful. That trigger, that moment when you, like, let's imagine the digital camera. If you were talking to the executives in Kodak initially when they were making that decision, and if you were saying, you know, you care about the quality of the picture, but what about immediacy? What about the Polaroid camera now that we associate with the immediate, right, the picture you can take. So changing the game a little bit, and that trigger, that moment, is what we see. Triggers groups to go, wait a minute, maybe we don't actually know the criterion. Maybe we don't know what's needed, the quality, what that means. I think groups believe, they think they all share a common view of what these things are, and that harms their ability to choose the new, because new things don't fit. But when groups do choose it, they fracture their understanding. They're like, wait a minute, it could be this. But wait a minute, maybe customers care about this. We've been focusing on this. Maybe it's this. And it's that fracturing and that diversity of perspective about what actually a large market is, why customers want to buy it, what actually is feasible long term, that fracturing keeps the idea alive. It's the shared understanding, and which is often driven by trust, that completely kills them. So, but if the trust is there, then the fractured understanding helps. But if the trust isn't there, then of course. So trust isn't bad. It just doesn't necessarily the mechanism, the thing that's helping groups keep these things alive. Yeah. Hi.
Hi. I work in a group that is focused on innovation. It's a research group of the company, and we have a lot of difficulty getting the rest of the company on board for something that's much more future out, like 5 to 10 years out. Mm. And even 5 to 10 years out, customers may not necessarily recognize the value. So it's harder to convince through the customer angle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's harder to convince from a creativity angle. Any advice on that?
Yes. And this is a broader strategic kind of question. And so what we are thankful for in the US are early adopters, you know, and the people who can kind of look at it and work at it. And what's wonderful about social media is that they've developed communities and they can start to talk to one another. So, I mean, I hear a lot about creating the ecosystem. So in some ways, when you are being creative, you have to remember that what's seen as creative to your consumer is a redefining of something that with their starting point, not your start. You're an innovator, right? So your starting point's like way out here. You're thinking artificial intelligence, and the consumer might be thinking, look, I'm using this software. That's my starting point. And it's coming from that starting point, and finding a way to show them that there's just a reinterpretation of that starting point. So they could say, oh, yeah, they can get it. Does that make sense? So a lot of times when we're in design mode and we're so far ahead of our end user because we've thought about so many different ways, we forget to bring it back to that moment. Like and I think this explains why Apple was really successful, and I think all of us kind of know this, with the iPod and then went to from the iPod to the iPhone. There was a progression there. You know what I mean? And the iPod was just a version of an MP3 player, which was a version of a Walkman, which was a right? And so it's giving them those bridges to move them forward as they, so they can understand what it is, as opposed to being like, ooh, this is scary, I don't know. Although your early adopters, they'll like the scary. You know what I mean? So you just have different communities of people who will like different things. But to bring those others along, it's just a process of understanding where they're at. People don't understand creativity if it's too different. It's just how our brains work. It's not that ideas need to be familiar, it's true, but we can't even tell the difference between something that is very different. If you have two different things, people are bad at telling all the differences between them. If you have two things that are kind of similar, then people can tell the differences really quickly. So it's and they can feel more comfortable with them. So it's just that's how I think about it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm so sorry we're actually at time, so I'm so sorry about that. But let's give Jennifer a big round of applause. That was fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So, and just so you know, Jennifer's going to be signing copies of her book out in the exhibit hall right now. And if you check either the program or your app, you can see what sessions are coming next. Thank you for spending your time with us today.